Hello everyone, this is Janine Blackwell, creator of Create Six Figure Courses, and I am incredibly excited to bring to you some really powerful inspiration, some great tools for building your coaching, your consulting, your teaching others business, and really some things that have really inspired me. And I got a little story I'll share with you about that in a minute. But first, I want you to meet our brilliant guest, Mark Barden, who is with us, co-author of A Beautiful Constraint, How to Transform Your Limitations into Advantages and Why It's Everyone's Business, which I love that title. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well, Janine. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to have you, and I've been talking about this with everybody, so I think everybody here is excited to have you, so really happy to be here. And for anybody who's kind of new to our conversation here today, you know, it's really fascinating when I look at the work that Mark's doing. Like, his background is like perfect for the conversation that we're all in every day. You know, officially, Mark runs the West Coast business for Eat Big Fish. So Eat Big Fish is a top brand consulting firm that are really known as the go-to experts in how you can do more with less, which, if does that sound familiar to any of you guys? Because as we build a brand, we're all trying to figure out how can I do more with less, and that's really what Mark does. So he's an expert in, you know, taking the things that folks like us often see as our limitations, like our, you know, gee, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, my resources are limited, or gee, I don't know how to do this, and repositioning that as an advantage. And that is really, I think, a conversation everybody here is really excited to talk about. So happy to have you here, Mark. So that is, I know, your official bio. You know, that's the place where when I'm hearing somebody read that, I kind of cringe a little bit. This is the official bio that you're reading. And I know that if we were standing in line at Starbucks and some kind of way struck up a conversation over our mochas, and I said, well, what do you do, Mark? You would probably say something a little different. So what would you say?
Well, I'd say I work for a company called Eat Big Fish. And the entire story of Eat Big Fish is really in the name itself, which is a good example, I think, of a beautiful constraint, which I know we're going to talk about in a moment. But we help little fish eat the big fish. Sometimes it's not always about, you know, the kind of people that listen to your show, solopreneurs, as you call them. Sometimes it's about large companies who have bigger ambitions than their resources allow. But it's always about how can we help you punch above your weight, do more with less, win, triumph against all the odds.
Yeah, and I think that's a conversation everybody hears in. It doesn't matter where you are, you know, in whatever level of growth you're in, you are in your business, I think you're always asking yourself that question because, you know, the opportunity gets bigger and the gap still stays in front of you, right, between where you are and where you want to be. I think that's an ever-evolving movement of the gap. And when I first discovered A Beautiful Constraint, there's kind of a story I promised you guys. So I discovered the book. My ritual is like I have this chair I like to sit down and read in, and I got my coffee in the morning, and I could not put this book down. It was great, great, great. And my mark of a great book, and I read a lot of them, is how marked up it is, right? I have a pen in my hand, and I'm making notes as I go through, and I, every page, marked up, marked up. And I typed up the notes and I shared the notes with my team. And, you know, we were right away starting to put to use the methods you were talking about because we were deep in planning for next year, right? We were going into planning. And so that just shaped the conversation differently. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you today, with everybody here, because it really is what you're sharing that in the book is that idea that to unlock the potential of that constraint that's in front of us, we have to, the first thing we got to do is really increase our level of ambition in regard to the constraint, rather than doing that thing that I think is so human nature called decreasing it, right? Oh, it's a big challenge, so I'll just decrease my vision a little bit because I don't have the resources. But the idea that the tension that that creates is really the key, I think, is to growth and innovation is just really powerful. So I wonder if we could start with like an example of that, that you could share with us about that powerful potential that lives in the constraint.
Yeah, I mean there are so many, and I'll talk about a number of them in rapid fire succession. Some of them are stories that are kind of accidental examples of, hey, there was a constraint, and guess what? It turned out to be a really powerful propeller of ideas. And sometimes it's much more deliberate and systematic than that. And we've discovered companies that actually don't simply wait for constraints to land in their lap, but actually go looking for them because they've found that these constraints can have really great potential. So I'll start with the story that opens the book, and it's kind of a silly one in a way, but it's a really quick read, and it's a story about the Rolling Stones. It's early 60s. They're a five-piece band. They're just getting started, and they've got a lot of gear, but they're playing tiny venues, as you might imagine, the back of pubs in London. And they walk out on stage, and by the time they've got set up, there's about 2 square feet in which Mick Jagger has to perform. And Mick Jagger has already determined that he needs to be the most charismatic rock and roll star of all time, so he's got to get the audience's attention. But how can he do that when he's got such a small space? And if you can imagine, picture in your mind Jagger doing his signature rooster move, and he's clapping his hands over his head, and he's quite, flamboyant on stage. It came about as a consequence of playing such small venues. And it's just a really good illustration, I think, of, now everybody, even what, 150 years since that band started or whatever it is now, we all know what that looks like. He's become very famous for it. And that's an accidental one. There's a great story from the world of video games about the creation of Mario, the character. And Mario was, one of the biggest, probably arguably still one of the biggest gaming platforms, profiles that's ever been created in that world, but at the time it was huge. And Mario looks the way he looks, and if you're not familiar with that character, he's a little stout Italian plumber. He wears overalls, he has a huge mustache, and he has a hat. And these were ideas that came to the designer because they were rendering in 8-bit graphics, and they couldn't render the kind of detail that we all know now. And so using a hat meant they didn't have to render hair. Using a huge mustache meant they didn't have to render a mouth. Putting overalls on him was a great way to demarcate, oh, this is where the arms start and the legs start. And that made him a really different looking character than anybody else in the video game business at the time, and was, arguably one of the things that propelled him to fame and fortune. So another example of how the constraints themselves, rather than being something that are inevitably going to thwart us and hold us back and prevent us from meeting our ambitions, sometimes with the right mindset, with the right methodology, some ways to get started thinking about it, and the right motivations to persist in the face of inevitable failure, those very limitations that we think just automatically are guaranteed to thwart us can turn out to be the sources of inspiration and better ideas than we would have come up with if we'd had enough. And that's the core idea of the book.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really resonated when you were sharing those stories. When I think about Mick Jagger, and you said that he had already decided, right? He had decided to be the leader in that space and be this most charismatic, rock star. He was going to be it, right? He already decided. And I thought, wow, that's a great example of what we're talking about here. It's like deciding that, okay, that I'm going to raise the ambition up no matter what space I'm operating in, like literally what space. And I think that's really powerful. And I think that for everybody here listening, everybody here has somebody else in your space that you look to as a leader in your space. And it's sometimes easy to look at what you're working with as resources and saying, oh, I don't know that I could be that, so I'm going to have to settle for being this. And it's the flip. I think it's about you got to make the decision first to be it, and then that shows up is what I'm really hearing the stories you're sharing.
Yeah, and I think, it's somewhat counterintuitive. So for most people, and I include myself in this, to be honest, and we found this in the book, was that, most people's relationship with constraints or limitations is inevitably to sit there and go, well, this happened. How am I going to get over that? I'm going to be, it's inevitable that I'm going to be defeated by this. And we call this the victim mindset. And We initially thought, well, you know, when we were starting this survey of all these different cases and meeting various people who've been able to become what we ultimately called transformers, we thought, well, there must be three kinds of people. Just like in the same way that you think about leadership as there are different styles of leadership, there must be different styles of people that have different relationships to constraints. But actually what we found is that it's a journey that most people are capable of going on, and I'll talk about why they don't go on in a moment, but all of us will start with the victim mindset, which is, ugh. And we talked to a famous designer, a guy called Michael Bayrut, who's a partner at a big New York design firm called Pentagram. And, you know, his work is legendary. He's got all kinds of success, track records, stories up the yin yang, great craft skills, all the capabilities you'd need to be living the transformer space all the time. And he said, No, guys, listen, let me tell you, every time somebody walks into my office with another impossible brief from a client, I immediately go to this victim mindset, which is throw my hands in the air, moan about, well, we're not, that's not possible, it can't possibly be done. All the stuff that is kind of human nature, I suppose, in a way, it's that fight or flight instinct that kicks in. You either run away or you get really angry. And it was really interesting because I think it allowed us to say, you know what? So that place that most people go to is a quite natural place to go to. So let's say to them, when this happens, a competitor launches something at half the price, your boss tells you you've got to get something done in half the time, somebody changes the rules of the category you're in completely, allow yourself to go to that victim mindset first, use it as a cathartic experience, dwell on all the bad stuff and get it out. But then, and this is critical, and we got this insight from another insight from Dr. Gabrielle Oettingen at the New York State University, runs the Motivation Lab there. She said when she's trying to get people to do behavior change, it's about immediately going from that stage of sort of dwelling in all the crap and then indulging yourself in the fantasy of, well, what would it be like if I could turn this around? She calls it mental contrasting. And she says the power that exists between the dwelling on the one hand and the indulging on the other is really critical to establish the tension. And it's the tension that's going to be the energy that fuels you through this process of making change happen. So, you know, Jagger knows he wants to be the most charismatic rock and roll star in the world. He's got that sort of indulged himself in what this is going to be like for him. But he dwells in, well, this sucks because I've got 3 feet. You know, and it's the tension between those two things that forces him to invent something the world has never seen before. And we saw that pattern time and time again. So saying to people, allow yourself to be in the victim mentality. And then the next stage is the neutralizer mentality, which is, can we get to a place where we can say, huh, well, that happened, but there's probably a workaround. There's probably something we can do differently that we haven't thought of before that's going to allow us to still meet our ambition and yet, you know, work around that constraint. And there's certain tools that we use to get people to that place. But beyond that is a place that where we all need to get to, probably not all the time, but more often than we're doing today, which is called the transformer mindset. And this is to start to engage with that constraint as an opportunity in disguise and figure out what it's trying to teach us that's going to change our fortunes in some way and change the way we think about how we go about things.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's all in the art of the question, you know, as you talk about that quite extensively in the book, that, you know, what it's the conversation we're having inside of our minds that influences what we see. And we talk about that in our programs, you know, because my passion is too also understanding what creates behavior change and what allows us to create results through the products we create, the programs we create. And and I know that what filters our attention are the questions that we ask. So if I'm asking myself a question and I'm looking for the answer to it, I'm going to only notice the things that give me that answer that I'm looking for. Just as if once we've decided something is a certain way, we as humans look for evidence that that is true, that we're accurate and that we're right. I mean, we like that, right? And so we're always looking for evidence to back up what we already know. And the key to seeing things that you're not seeing currently is to notice the question you're asking and to say, wow, is this question helping me see what I need to see? And I, you know, I'm listening to you and I thought, you know, probably the biggest leap that happened in my business, not probably, it was, you know, when I first started my business, I spent years building my consulting business and I was working with a lot of great Fortune 500 clients, and the way I had structured it was that as we got every new level of success, right, I was traveling more and more because I had built the business that way. And I found myself in that place going, in the victim place, right? You're talking about like, oh, I got to travel again. Why is this? You know, oh, I have to, right? And it wasn't until I switched the question a bit and made that decision called, no, there's got to be another way. I mean, the question is, yes, we want to double our business. So how can I double my business and not be the one doing this, right? Not being on a plane. And that little shift was huge in seeing things that I didn't see before. And, you know, I know everybody here's wanting to know, okay, so how do I get better at noticing those questions and how do I create questions that are, as you call them, propelling questions?
Yeah, so a propelling question is a device that we came up with to, you know, so the whole intention of the book is to look at a number of these case studies, break it down into a series of steps so that people can get started and be just a little bit more systematic and methodical about working through this than we are today when we just kind of go into panic mode. It's you know, a little bit of infrastructure you can build on. And so one of the key ideas is a propelling question, which is designed in some way to create that tension that I talked about, the mental contrasting thing of Gabrielle Oettingen, to create that tension in the way that you consciously decide what are the critical questions for my business. You can apply this to personal life. I'll talk about that in a minute as well if you want, which can enshrine that kind of tension. So a propelling question is, get very clear on what your ambition is. You need to make it quite specific. It needs to be way bigger than you've ever thought before. And then couple that to your biggest constraint. And it might be that, you know, there's ways to sort of make a list. I, you know, say to people, make a list of your sort of overall ambition and then drill down, unpack it a little bit, make a list of sub-ambitions that you need to meet. Talk about the constraints, make a number of lists, and start pairing them together to form really interesting propelling questions. So I'll give you an illustration. It's against another easy one to get our heads around. It's a big company. It's Audi. And Audi's decided its kind of biggest ambition is to become the most prestigious automobile brand in the world. So a very, very lofty ambition. And they break that down into a series of sub-ambitions, one of which is we need to win on the racetrack. And you go, okay, great. So we need to win on the racetrack. The constraint they had is the kind of engines, and Audi's not building Ferrari engines. So the kind of constraints they have is, well, we don't have more powerful engines than anybody else. If anything, we're sometimes inferior in terms of power. So how can we win the race when our engine will go no faster than anybody else's? Was the way that the chief engineer arrived at framing this propelling question to give to his engineers to say, if we can answer that, if we can meet our ambition without spending billions in R&D to develop more and more powerful engines, which might not be possible anyway, if we can answer that question, we are golden. And of course, it forced his engineers to think about novel solutions they might not ordinarily have done. The short answer to that long story is that they decided they would race the Le Mans 24-hour race, which is a famous endurance race in Europe, over 24 hours, with a turbo diesel engine. A diesel engine is more fuel efficient. It allows the car not to go any faster. In fact, it's somewhat slower, but it comes off the track less often. And as Scott Keogh, the president of Audi, said to us when he was telling us this story, there is no engine in the world that can make up for a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 second pit stop every couple of hundred miles over a 24-hour race. They won 1, 2, and 3 the first year they entered with the turbo diesel. And of course, as soon as you hear that story, you go, how obvious. How did not all the other car companies not understand that? But it's because, and this is a really important point to land with the listeners here, is because they have a whole set of assumptions and biases and of how the category works, preconceived ideas about how to win races. Winning races is about building faster engines. No, it's not, turns out. And it takes sometimes something counterintuitive and the framing of a question that at face value, taken at face value, is impossible to answer to force you. That's why it's called a propelling question. It propels you into different solution spaces, looking at ideas that you ordinarily wouldn't consider. And that's its real value, I think, in breaking what we call path dependence, your habitual behaviors that served you well and therefore very good reason periodically need to be completely flipped on their head, and a propelling question will do that.
So I know that someone listens to you, and you are connecting with all these different clients, and you guys are all over the world working. And in truth, as we were talking about earlier, it's you're living the life of somebody who is in a small business, right? As a lot of folks here are. And when you think about the art of that question and how that's kind of shown up as in your own growth of your company. What does that look like? Has there been any ahas for you that have come out of asking those questions?
Well, I'll tell you, in the spirit of complete candor, that it is a daily challenge to adopt this mindset. I find myself going to the victim mindset routinely. But there was a great moment in there was a great moment of in writing this book, which I may come back to. But when we'd finally finished 3 years of research, immersed ourselves in the intensity of writing this book together, Adam Morgan and I, my writing partner, and we got it out there, and we were feeling very pleased with ourselves, like, phew, thank goodness that's over. The publisher said, you know that that was the easy bit. The hard part starts now. You have to make this book a hit. And making this book a hit when thousands of business titles are coming out every month is the biggest challenge. We're like, oh, whoa, no wonder they didn't tell us that before we started. So we had this, he said, you've got to do a book tour of the States. Now, Eat Big Fish is not McKinsey. It's not a large consulting firm. There are 17 people that work at Eat Big Fish, most of them in London. So we framed a propelling question for ourselves, which is, how can we go on a US book tour launch without spending any of our own money?
That's a great question.
Yes,
I love
very
that
challenging.
question. Yeah.
Now, of course, we had to spend money on flights and stuff, so there was
Right.
a little bit of our own expense. But that's a great. So we did for ourselves an exercise that's in this book called Creating Abundance, and it basically says if you don't have resources, you have to be really resourceful. And resourcefulness, how do we do that then? Great. So again, it's kind of this list making, which is list out all the assets that you have. And not only is that a great exercise to do because you're feeling down in the dumps, you're in that victim space, I have nothing, I have no money for my Facebook campaign, whatever. Make a list of all the things you do have. And you have lots, everybody has lots. And then figure out ways to look at those very same things and reframe the value, repackage the value that exists in those things. And for us, it was about saying, well, Adam and I both come out of the advertising business. And we're like, we have great friends in the advertising business, all of whom are fabulous fancy offices, the lobbies of which would look great for a book party, wouldn't they? And you know what they would love? They would love to be able to say to their clients, sneak preview, latest book from these two guys from the industry, really going to be great. We've got them first. The book's not out yet. Come to a party. We'll do it in the atrium of the agency. So we framed it to them as an exclusive for you to host a party, to invite your clients. You can look like the thought leaders. You can get people together for a rich and interesting conversation. Great. So far, so good. Here's an issue. If it's going to be a good party, we have to have some drink, right? Who have we worked with in the last X number of years who's a drinks client? So we called up Campari Sky that I'd recently done a big project with on Sky Vodka and said, here's what I know, Jason, about this brand. This brand needs to reach influencers. It needs to reach cultural creatives, the kind of people that would show up at a book launch party in a fancy ad agency in San Francisco and LA and Chicago and New York. And he said, we would. And funnily enough, we've got a new cocktail coming out. I said, great. How would you like to pour at these parties? We would love that. So they create not just a pour, but they built a bar experience to show off their brand to these influencers, and so on and so forth. There are many different layers to it, but the whole point
I
was
love that.
everybody in that relationship was getting exactly what they wanted, right? There was what we call, it's the mutually beneficial hustle of 21st century business. This is how it needs to work. You need to go cut deals with people. The Sky people were delighted to reach these people. Our agency partners were delighted to be able to host this event. We were thrilled to be able to throw a six venue US book launch without having to dig into our own pockets.
I love that. I love that on so many levels. And like I just wrote down, the mutually beneficial hustle. Because like we call it win-win, right? But that sounds so much sexier. I like that. And we were just having a conversation yesterday. I was talking to some folks that were creating an experience, right? And they were thinking, wow, how can I have like these thought leaders I want to come to this experience be part of it? And that's exactly what you're getting to is that exercise of think about, you know, what you have to offer, what are you bringing to the table in that experience, and looking at those connections you have. And yeah, and at the end of the day, it's about hustle, right? It's really
Well,
good.
Elizabeth, let me tell you another story, because I just love this aspect of the book, and it's one of the things that's proving to be the most fruitful and productive for clients. So this is a slightly different way, because I think what I want to have everybody understand is the creativity part of this, is the reframing of what you have. So this is a story about Virgin America and the launch of Virgin America in the US in 2007. So launching an airline is a very expensive job, right? Because you've got to spend $300 million a piece on the Airbus 320s that Virgin America flies. So by the time they've finished building the infrastructure and the airplanes, they don't have any money for a marketing launch. And so they're stuck there with, we've got to fill these planes. What are we going to do? And, you know, they've built, I don't know if you've flown on a Virgin America flight, but they've got black leather seats throughout. They've got this kind of purple mood lighting. It feels more like a nightclub than an airplane. They've got seatback TVs. They've got free Wi-Fi on board and so on. So they've got a great experience. But they're sitting there and they're going, well, what assets do we have then? Well, we've got the planes and we've got this free Wi-Fi and so on. We've got, what else do those things represent? What is an airplane? What does it represent? And the thinking was, well, it's captive eyeballs, right? You're in an aluminum tube in the sky. There's no way you can go. Everybody's looking the same way. We've got to, what can we do with those captive eyeballs? And they also know that they are an airline that is trying to put glamour back into the sky. So they're very clear about their own sense of identity. And I think this is a really critical part for everybody. Knowing who they are and what they're trying to project and what their impression they're trying to make in the world led them to, well, look, if we're trying to put glamour back into the sky, let's make a list of all the glamorous businesses we could approach. Most airlines will go to hotel chains and do partnerships. That's easy. What's a glamorous place we could go? And they went to Victoria's Secret and they said, how would you like to put on a fashion show in the sky? The first ever fashion show in the sky. We'll be flying your models to LA because they're going for this fashion show anyway. Let's do that. And of course, no money changed hands for that deal. What happens? Everybody on the airplane has their smartphones out. They're taking pictures. They're sharing all these pictures. The pictures show what it looks like to be on a Virgin America flight, the black leather seat, seatback TV, the mood lighting, and they've got this kind of patina of glamour because it's Victoria's Secret, and that just went off on social media, and suddenly they've got a marketing campaign that cost them nothing.
I love that too. It's like idea after idea. It just really, when you swim up, you just think, wow, okay, the question, it's all in the question, right? It's about reframing the question so you see it differently. And I think it's a discipline that you have to catch yourself, right? Because it's so easy to get into that old path of like, well, this is the question I ask. How do I do what I do with what I have versus looking outside and moving to that other place called resourceful. I love what you said too about, you know, when you're in the place where you don't have the resources, you have to be resourceful. And I think that's a really big, big takeaway from this conversation for everybody, because we all have resources, and sometimes we diminish them because we don't even realize how powerful they are.
Yeah.
It's really, really good.
Yeah. And it's a very much a sort of, I think, you know, I'm sitting talking to you from San Francisco, the Bay Area, and you know, here in Silicon Valley, this mutually beneficial hustle thing is very much a feature of startups. And when they get going, there's a lot of trading that goes on of value between them. But, you know, we spoke to a very prominent, I won't mention, Fortune 100 chief marketing officer who said, if I cut the budget of all my leading brands by half, these guys wouldn't know how to get started. And that's really interesting because they'd still be left with more money than we have on a good day. But you know, that sense that abundance of resources, number one, can be its own form of toxic situation. Economists call it the resource curse. You know, if you look at the countries that have tons of oil in the ground, for instance, in the Gulf states, they are not the most progressive societies in the world, and they don't have particularly well-developed economies because we got all the oil we need, we're done. And it's just not a very good situation to be in. So there is a personal resource curse. Even for small businesses, there are potentially resource curses. You're used to using the same resource over and over and over again. And the critical thing is, and it's, you know, a lot of coaches listening to this, I know, it's about how do you create behavior change? How do you break habits? How do you create new habits? And this discipline of coming back to framing the questions differently, framing the way you think about the resources you do have and what it is you have to offer. It is a discipline of, you know, you're basically, it's a new practice for creating new results.
Yeah, I love that. And it was one of the takeaways when I read the book. You know, one of the things that I wrote down, you know, as I looked at what is working best in our business. So when I look at the primary source of where all of our new relationships are formed, you know, where people find us and they come in and start a relationship with us and engage in our programs. And the flip of that, you know, looking at that, the new question was, okay, what if that went away and we still wanted to be on the same growth trajectory? Like if we could not rely on that, what would we be doing differently? And just that question got us out of that curse of having something working, right? Because when it's working, you start to rely on it, and then you're missing that out of that dialogue, what we saw lots of opportunities that we're leaving on the table, right? Because we're so focused on the thing that is working, and taking that out of your view for a minute allows you to see new things. So I think that's a really, really, really great point. It's very powerful. So we could go on and on and on. And one of the things I want to say to everybody is that when Mark and I were getting started right before we got on, Mark graciously said that, hey, you know, I'm thrilled to continue this conversation. So if people have questions or comments that are coming up as they're listening to this podcast and they want to post it, you know, in the comments, I'm happy to come back and, you know, respond in the post and really share. So I just would love everybody to think of this as an initial start to a conversation, right? Because there's going to be things that are going to come up for you as you listen to this. And then as you read the book, more comes up for you. And I thought what would be a great question for us to kind of land on as we finish our conversation for now, because I have a feeling we're going to continue this, is that, you know, you've been through this process, right? You've been listening to lots of stories. You've had so many clients, and I'm sure there's been lots of things that have been great learning lessons for you in that process. What has been the best advice you've ever received that kind of has stuck with you and potentially informed, you know, the parameters of what it is you're doing here? What's that best piece of advice that you would share with the rest of us?
Oh, there's so many. The one I'm quite hot on at the moment, and it'll be different next week, so ask me again then, is this idea which I got from Timothy Wilson, another psychologist. We read a lot of, you know, literature about in the academic journals about creativity and how it works and so on. And Timothy Wilson has a very powerful and deceptive line. It says, we are the stories we tell ourselves. And I'm sure that rings true for lots of people. And so the reason that we talk in the book about mindset, method, and motivation in that order is we strongly believe that you can't get started with the method until you've got the right mindset. And that has to come from finding a story in your own biography, in your own history, in the history of your company, maybe it's, you know, somebody close to you, that is a story of a beautiful constraint, a story of a limitation, a constraint appeared, we all thought we were doomed, it turned out to be a blessing in disguise. And getting in touch with that story and saying, you know, if we've done this once before, or my friend has done it, my uncle's done it, we can do this again. Because the belief that it is possible to turn a constraint into a beautiful constraint is essential before you embark on this process. So, and it's our advice to large companies too is, you know, they come to us and go, we can't do this. Yes, you can. Let's go back through the history of this company and find the 6 or 7 seminal stories of where you've been able to do this. Tell ourselves how, just prove to each other how transformational they were for the business. And then tell ourselves the story that this is who we are. Any story, any company that's been through a growth, on a growth curve, has something like this. And it's, we just don't tell those stories enough. We're trying to change the stories that people tell themselves in order to become, you know, feel more confident about being a transformer. So tell yourself a different story, find something, write it down, stick it on a piece of paper, read it out loud to each other. That's who you are.
Mm, that is great. I love that. I think that's a great place for us to land, and an enormous takeaway that we can all put to use right away. So thank you so much for that, Mark. And so tell me, tell us a little bit if we want to get connected with you. So I'm now like ready, right? I want to read the book. I want to get connected with you. What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, well, there's multiple ways. And I did say at the very beginning, Janine, how much I loved getting your first email, because as an author, you write a book, you put it out in the world, and occasionally you'll get these emails from people saying, hey, I read it and I like it. I love that. So Mark, M-A-R-K, at eatbigfish.com. I'm very good on email. Might take me a few days, but I'll get back to you. Follow me on Twitter because we're always putting stuff out there. Mark C. Barden, B-A-R-D-E-N, on Twitter. We're putting constantly stories out there. And I think go to the company website. Go to eatbigfish, all one word, .com. If you scroll down, just it's on the first page, beautiful constraint. If you tell us who you are, send us an email, we'll send you the introduction chapter free. So you don't have to commit to the whole book at this point. Get the intro chapter. If you like what you see there, then you can obviously sign up for more and get and buy the book. And you can sign up to get further weekly, monthly inspiration from us. We don't spam people. We're quite careful. But there's lots of ways. And those are just three.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you, everybody, for joining in. And any final thoughts? One last thought, Mark, before we say goodbye to everybody?
Well, I just think the key word in the title of the book for me is beautiful. So I would just say, you know, this, hang on to that too, that idea that we're all looking for more elegant, more beautiful, better solutions to stuff. That this book is one route to that.
Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you, guys. And we will talk soon. So stay connected. And please, I love the opportunity we have here to connect with Mark, very graciously sharing your email to connect with us. You can connect in the comment thread. And I think this is an opportunity for everybody to really dig in and really look at those questions that could propel us all forward. So thank you for joining.